Okay, so this is going to be the first episode of the relaunched 24 Frames cast. If you want to find out why I'm doing this, just listen to the previous episode. However, this is how it's all going to work. Each season of the 24 Frames cast will consist of 10 episodes that will be released every week on a Sunday. There will then be a 2-week pause, and then season 2 will begin, and so on and so on. I have deleted all the back episodes from the feed. Some of them will be coming back, re-recorded, expanded. Some of them will be edited down. Some of them will be rewritten, but some of them will definitely be coming back. Others won't. But for the time being, at least, this is the first episode of the new 24 Frames cast, and it's going to be a look at Zabriskie Point.
Same old jive that's been run down for the past 300 years. If y'all so wise and heavy, why didn't you join the strike in the beginning? Nah, you just go back and tell them, sorry, this motherfucker is closed down on strike, Jack, and we're whistling the store.
Why doesn't the strike committee add some of our demands, like ending ROTC?
How?
You want to off ROTC. All you have to do is go down to the ROTC building, take a bottle, fill it full of gasoline, plug it with a rag.
Yeah, man, but what if you want to end sociology?
Listen, man, Old Top Cocktail is a mixture of gasoline and kerosene. White Radical is a mixture of bullshit and jive. Right on.
2014 was, in retrospect, for me personally, one of the defining years of my life. For the years previous, I had been in a relationship with a person who I had not actually been in love with since we'd bought a house together in 2009. I had simply put on a facade of being in a relationship. We got on well, and there was very little tension between us, so is it easy, for the sake of a comfortable life, to just plod along? And surely, I rather naively thought, wasn't this what most people were doing anyway? Turns out, I was probably wrong, and fear began to take hold of me. My life was a lie, in which I played a role, and the performance was becoming harder to maintain. Mercifully, it was she that decided to end our relationship, and I, along with the cats that were the most important item in my divorce settlement, moved to a new home on the outskirts of Manchester. Living alone quickly made me realise how bored and listless my life had become, and relief came over me. I did more things I wanted to do, and essentially believed for the first time in years I was content in a way I had not been for a long while. The summer of 2014 was also gorgeous, and I decided to take 2 weeks off to watch the end of the Tour de France and enjoy simple doing nothing. And it was during this period that it began. Most of my social life had evolved around my ex-partner's friends, and I realised, despite the new beginning, I was to a large extent on my own. Yes, there were my friends, but children had arrived, and quite simply, people weren't around as much as they used to be. And questions began to swirl around. What was I doing with my life? Was I where I wanted to be? Would I meet someone else? All I did was spend money on stuff, clothes, books, Blu-rays, games, and of course a fair amount of booze. And good Lord, living alone was expensive, I had discovered. I felt in those 2 weeks a kind of apprehension, undefined and seemingly elusive. I knew things were better, but was this it? After watching a day's Tour de France, I retreated into my film room that I had built in the top of my house. It was at this stage the single greatest thing going on in my life, and I decided I would do a director binge, and that director would be Michelangelo Antonioni. Watching his characters on screen was the perfect tonic for me at this stage. If ever there was a case of a right director at the right time, this was it. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I suddenly felt some huge, profound connection to his work, but he seemed to capture a mood and feeling that in that precise moment, to a degree, that I was experiencing. It was the trilogy of La Ventura, L'Eclisse and La Notte that had so won me over. And watching these films and emerging into the bright summer days, I experienced something of a rare thing. Sometimes, I am sure, films literally make you experience the world in a slightly different way. Watch anything by Terrence Malick and go for a walk in nature afterwards. And believe me, if you have a functioning soul, everything from the wind moving through the leaves to the sound of running water will all seem slightly more inspiring. And after I wandered out of a Michelangelo Antonioni film, especially on a warm summer's day, the street seemed a little bit emptier, a lot quieter, and I myself would wander around lost in my own thoughts in a mood and state that I simply hadn't been a few hours before. Now, this may be fairly fleeting, but it's a testament to how films can make us feel and react. What did emerge from this period in my life was an appreciation of the films of Michelangelo Antonioni. They've been a regular part of my rotation ever since. He is a director whose work was seemingly made for film criticism and history. A wide range of film academics have and continue to pore over his work, re-evaluating, analysing and pontificating over it. And it's worth remembering, he wasn't universally adored. I know one fairly well-known film historian who maintains he is an overrated bore, and Quentin Tarantino has on the Brett Easton Ellis podcast been largely dismissive of his work in the past. I, however, have been hooked ever since that summer of 2014. And for a good while, I pretty much stuck to watching his earlier films. I did see Blow Up and, of course, The Passenger, his brilliant Jack Nicholson film. Yet there was one film that I had avoided, mainly because I'd heard so much negativity surround it. It'd been called expensive, pretentious and dull. And the film in question, of course, was his 1970 Zabriskie Point. Now, along with Call Me By Your Name and Interstellar, this is the film I have watched the most over the past 10 years. Now, I'm not going to make a claim that Zabriskie Point is some misunderstood masterpiece of cinema, but I am going to try and make the case it is a worthy addition to the Michelangelo Antonioni filmography. Time, I believe, has been kind on the film. Yes, the desert orgy scene is still terrible. After all, aren't most sex scenes anyway? And the casting of Mark Fachette and Daria Helbrin in the lead roles of Mark and Daria certainly shows that the pair were not chosen for their acting ability. Moreover, they were cast pretty much on looks and looks alone, and compelling they are definitely not. Critics of the film tend to centre around the film's rather superficial exploration of American counterculture, two-dimensional student politics, its rather obvious critique of consumer culture. It also committed the sin of being a big-budget, high-profile financial disaster, recouping a mere $1 million off a $7 million budget. Now, for context, a mid-budget Hollywood film in the 1980s would have cost the same. It seems perhaps that critics and audience thought they were going to be getting a cinema verite Michelangelo Antonio take on American culture, as opposed to the large budget Hollywood Michelangelo take on American culture, which is the precise reason why I like the film. It's Michelangelo Antonioni in America bringing his sensibility as a filmmaker to the country. Before I dive into the film, here is a brief synopsis of what it is about. We begin at a gathering of students and Black Panthers on a university campus. Unrest and protest has broken out, and students and the police and National Guard have been called in. At first, it appears we may have stumbled into a documentary. Students talk over each other as a camera moves around trying to keep up with the conversation. The main focus of the discussion is what will it make to make white people become revolutionaries, whereupon one student, Mark, chastises the group for not being radical enough and leaves. He gets himself arrested trying to get a roommate released from jail, gets hold of a pistol and may or may not shoot a police officer after the killing of an unarmed Black student. He makes an escape by stealing a plane and flying off towards the desert. Meanwhile, running parallel to all this, real estate executive Lee Allen, played by Rod Taylor, is reviewing a new advertisement for a desert resort. His assistant Daria, who he may or may not be having an affair with, is driving into the desert to visit a commune of a man from LA who works with emotionally disturbed children, and then onto a prearranged meeting with Lee at a sprawling house in the desert. Mark, in his plane, spies Daria and repeatedly buzzes her until he lands and meets up with her. The pair talk, have sex, decorate his plane in various slogans, but he flies back to LA to face the music. Daria travels to Lee's desert house, whereupon she leaves, turns around, and fantasizes about blowing up the building.
What's up, Daria? Where are you?
I'm in some ghost town. I just got to say I may be a little late in Phoenix.
Why?
I'm looking for a little town that sounds like Glenville or Valleyville or something like that. Something with a ville in it. You know the desert. Does that ring a bell?
A ville? Wait a minute. Hold on. A ville. What do you mean, like a Danville?
Somewhere in the desert, man. Danville's in Connecticut. Or maybe it's Hill. Something Hill.
Hill. Well, what do you want to go to a town you don't know the name of for? Have you got somebody to meet?
My friend said it's a fantastic place for meditation.
What do you do on a meditation?
You think about things.
You think about... Daria, look, give me the number where you're calling from, and I'll try and find out the name of the town and call you back, okay?
Oh, no, you'll probably have a helicopter sent out here to pick me up.
Come on, Daria.
30 cents, please, for the next 3 minutes.
Just a second, operator. Look, give me the number, then hang up, and I'll call you back, and that way I can pay for the call.
See you in Phoenix.
It's sometimes worth remembering that film is a visual medium that I believe can be appreciated in certain cases purely on its aesthetic pleasure. Average storylines can be elevated by a film's mise-en-scene, and Zabriskie Point is an example of this. Simply put, I just like looking at this film. Style can be substance if you are so inclined. And although Michelangelo Antonioni's shot choices is in service of the film's thematic and intellectual objectives, on repeat viewings, sometimes I've just watched this film for the simple pleasure of looking at it. It's his only scope film, and cinematographer Alfino Contini, and a vision of America is presented that often feels like some form of quasi-futuristic dystopia. After the 8-minute opening sequence, we cut to a young girl arriving at Lee's office. Her hippie appearance is in stark contrast to the modern decoration. With its circular security console and airy glass interior, there is an establishment in the framing of the scene to exemplify the film's us and them dynamic. The us are the young radicals, the them are the apparent establishment, the people in the suits, the people who need to be rebelled against. The scene itself is fairly dull, but the framing of the shots is so precise and presents such a clinical surveillance world of lifts, closed-circuit television and blunt-talking security guards. You associate what is being shown with the reason the students are talking about revolution a few moments earlier. This is corporate America. We know Lee is building homes, selling a lifestyle. We literally see this, as I'll explain later. And the compositions capture an otherness about this world, its sterility, and it's a sterility that is all too familiar to me. I've worked my fair share of terrible jobs, places of key fobs, call monitoring, daily targets, in which you have to pretend you actually care about enriching the dull-suited balls who run the place. Yet Antonioni has made this thing a place of visual beauty. Whoever would have thought such a thing was actually possible? In one scene, we see Lee to the out of focus to the extreme left, a CCTV monitor in the middle of the screen, and a standing security guard on the extreme right. Your eyes are encouraged to read the vision before you. I don't really hear the dialogue, it's dull anyways, and maybe it's meant to be, but the image alone, in of itself, keeps the scene strangely captivating. And whether intentional or not, for me at least, it has always helped me settle into Zabriskie Point. The widescreen frame is used to extenuate the fragmented nature of the characters' relationships. It allows for a visual representation of the disconnect between them, and to me, emphasised the film's weird otherness. Yes, this is America, but it's not one that I am necessarily comfortable in. The widescreen frame makes it feel oddly distant, and Antonio uses abstraction on the soundtrack with industrial noises, loud electronic shrieks, that when combined with the montages of advertising billboards and nondescript locations, deny us the tourist LA in favour of a subtly more sinister type of America. The titular Zabriskie Point is in Death Valley, and it's here where Dario and Mark wander into the desert, smoke some weed, and take part in what becomes a kind of surreal art house orgy. Yes, it's terrible, but aside from that, the actual location of Zabriskie Point is visually huge at this stage. The landscape dwarfs the character, as is often the case in Antonioni films, and Mark and Dario exchange flirtatious, slightly juvenile dialogue. The bleakness of the place, the otherworldliness of it, and its relationships, malaise of the film's characters, realise the importance of location in a director's work. Antonioni chooses places that fitted his story, that enriches them and his characters, and we see Darry and Mark talking nonsense and acting like children. The emptiness of their lives is perfectly captured in the vistas that we see before us. Yes, the characters might seem slightly lacking, but I can often find myself forgiving this just by simply looking at them and their surroundings, which, if the casting choices were meant to be believed, this is precisely what I was supposed to be doing.
What do you do besides fly airplanes?
Until yesterday, I drove a forklift truck at a warehouse. Done other things.
Been to college?
Some.
Why'd you leave? Grades?
Extracurricular activities.
Like what?
Like stealing hardcover books instead of paperbacks. Making phone calls on the chancellor's stolen credit card number. Whistling in class. And bringing illegal things onto campus, like a dog, a bike, a woman.
What's wrong with that?
We did it in the road. Yeah, they finally kicked me out after I broke into the dean's office and reprogrammed the computer. Put them uptight. Know why? I made all the engineers take art courses. She's gonna follow me down.
So, tell me the rest of your criminal record.
Once I changed my color, but it didn't work. So I changed back.
Did you hear that the Mexican Air Force is bombing the grass along the border?
I wonder what else is going on in the real world. Hear any news about the strike?
Not much. I prefer music.
It's getting like they don't even report it unless 200 or 300 people get hurt.
Yeah, some kind of record.
Or a cop.
Oh, a cop did get killed, and some bushes were trampled. I was trying to find a rock station. I think they said the guy who killed the cop was white.
Ooh, white man taking up arms with the blacks, huh? Just like old John Brown.
The first few times I watched Zabriskie Point, I was convinced that Mark had shot the police officer. I did see it. I was sure of it. One thing we notice about Mark is he seems to make things up. He lies to a gum shop owner about the threat of black people in order to be able to take home the weapon earlier, and it works. And when he speaks to Daria, he's clearly making things up as he goes along. Antonio and his characters often blurt things out, seemingly just random thoughts. Yet Mark seems different. He is a charlatan. He seems to be playing a role, the role being the radical militant revolutionary. But is he really? Watching the police shooting again, we almost think an error has occurred. Some frames might be missing, or Antonioni uses the cut to add ambiguity to Mark's story. He doesn't deny shooting, nor does he try and clear his name. You get the impression he likes the machismo of possibly being a cop killer, but seems to be too dim to realise the consequences of what he's done. The police are presented as a faceless authoritarian automatons, so we don't care that one of them just gets killed. But we know, even if Mark doesn't quite realise it, his days are pretty much numbered. There is a tension in the film. We keep going back to it. A cop appears at Zabriskie Point. Will Mark kill him? Will Daria rat him out? Although hardly a thriller, Zabriskie Point does have a sense of underlying urgency. How and when will Mark be found out? And it's a pertinent question that we as filmgoers feel compelled to ask, even if perhaps, as in this case, we might not necessarily be that interested in the outcome. The film's most celebrated sequence is its finale, in which Daria, having arrived at what we assume is Lee's desert modernist house, walks through and is largely ignores, and then leaves, and before getting a car, looks back as the house explodes, sending fragments through the air. It's an amazing sequence in which you had no idea how captivating seeing a half-eaten chicken flying through in 1,000 frames a second could be. Aside from the visual wonder of it, it does feel like a fitting, if highly abstract, ending. The film has hinted at the hallucinogenic, but this takes it to the next level. Darry's vision is apocalyptic, an act of violence committed as a fantasy. The film's opening with the Black Panther asking what will it take for white people to become militant is, in a way, answered. Mark claims to be militant, but is most likely not. We don't know if he shot the cop, but most likely he did not. The film has shown us what he is, and we take him, and he cannot be taken at his word. And Daria hardly seems that militant at all. She's possibly having an affair with the very people she should want to rebel against. And mostly the life direction of Daria Mark would be one toward conformity. They may well be appalled at the world they're trying to escape from, but I don't believe Zabriskie Point is offering its audience a call to arms. Moreover, it's a rather somber meditation on why most radicalism simply evaporates, especially in consumerist capitalist societies. In one sequence, we see Lee and his co-workers watching a mock-up of a new advertisement for a development. Plastic dolls have been replaced with the parts of humans, showing domestic bliss, mum in a kitchen, dad at leisure, and we cut back to the executives staring impassively. Maybe, just maybe, this is where Mark and Daria were destined to end up, not making love stoned in the desert, but marvelling at their appliances and perfect family. And there's even a sequence showing dad flying above the desert, something we of course see Mark doing as he buzzes Daria.
Enjoy the full relaxation of outdoor living. Bask in the desert sun by your own private pool. Why be caught up in the rat race of city life when you can enjoy life the Sunny Dunes way? Play tennis on emerald green lawns. Drink fresh mountain water from oaken buckets. Breathe the unpolluted air of the high desert. Take your son quail shooting in the wide open spaces. Who knows, you might even bag a mountain lion. Get out in the sun and water your own private garden. Become an independent man. Forge a life of your own like the pioneers who molded the West.
You gals will really enjoy the fully equipped Sunny Dunes kitchen. Plenty of space for cooking for Junior and for that man of the house.
Play a round of golf on the regulation size Sunny Dunes 9-hole golf course, and you can putt to your heart's content on the special practice putting green. So stop driving yourself crazy in that miserable, crowded city. Move out today and start your life over with a Sunny Dunes house in the sun.
Are you taking up flying, Bob?
No, Jane. That's me personally scanning the desert for potential Sunny Dunes lots. Just call Sunny Dunes 84868.
What's the number again, Bob?
That's Sunny Dunes Land Development Company, Box 82, Los Angeles, California.
The film's final sequence is totally unique. The explosion itself is huge. Filmed from several angles, we begin to see objects virtually frozen in midair. Along with Pink Floyd's Careful with the Axe, Eugene, the images and sound make a great montage of hypnotic destruction. We see a fridge explode, food hangs in the air. It's almost comical, unnerving, beautiful as well, as clothes appear in a variety of different colours. The soundtrack descends into screaming, and suddenly there is a visceral rage in the imagery before we cut back to silence and Daria smiling, looking on before she drives off into the sunset. Has she escaped, or was she just enjoying this fantasy? We know the idealism of the 60s gave way to the cynicism of the 70s. Gimme Shelter and the stabbing at the Altamont Speedway captured that final nail in the coffin. I'm always left with a feeling Michelangelo saw through the rhetoric of the radical movement, and through this ending makes a statement that it's not revolution Daria and Mark seek, but meaning. He was not a political filmmaker, and I don't see Zabriskie Point as a political film. Daria has been travelling throughout it, and after stopping at the house, once again is moving on to where we don't know, and I don't think it would be a Michelangelo Antonio film if we did. Now, it was not well received upon its release. Yes, it was expensive. Making films in America was, compared to Europe, and maybe for a counterculture youth film, its intended audience thought it too corporate or establishment, bearing in mind it was a large MGM production. Its central performances aren't exactly Oscar-worthy either, but all being said, I do adore this film. It's become a go-to of mine. Perhaps it doesn't achieve what it's trying to do, but I really don't care. It's an incredibly cinematic experience, a visual wonder of a film, and every time I see it, it makes me admire it even more. And I often find myself thinking about it. On a recent revisit, one shot in particular stood out to me. Daria drives away from Medina before the camera tracks in, and through a window we see a man alone at the bar, drinking and smoking. The camera stops and dwells on him. Perhaps he's going to play a part in the film, say something or do something. Instead, absolutely nothing happens. And I don't care that it doesn't. I just love the craft of the shot. It looks amazing, classic Americana. It might have a deeper reason for being there. It may come to me on another screening. But for now, like this film, I just like it as it is, no more and no less. So that's going to be that for this episode of the 24 Frames cast. There will be a new episode dropping next Sunday, where I'll be taking a look at what I consider to be the essential UHDs if you were to start a new collection. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do. I'm at Thomas24FC. Many thanks for listening, and I'll speak to you next week. Bye.